program along the U.S.-Mexico border that is putting tens of thousands of people in immediate danger and also giving them no chance of a fair shake at in their asylum claims.
Power Long, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior researcher, Human Rights Watch, and Arturo, not his real name, but for fear of a reprisal, speaking to us from El Salvador after being deported from the United States, where he lived for 19 years. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for paid year-long news production fellowship. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have you ever wanted to work in radio? Whether it be a hobby or maybe stepping stone to build your career? Henry Ford College has the right program for you. TCM 189 is an 8-week course that teaches the fundamentals of broadcasting and helps people become a better broadcaster. After completing the course, graduates will be eligible for a show right here on WHFR. For more information, go to hfcc.edu. There's only a few spots per semester, and seats fill up quickly. So log on to your web advisor today and reserve your place for TCM 189.
Did you ever ride your bike with a clothespin and a baseball card? Or use a typewriter for a school paper? Then here's a timely alert. Americans born from 1945 to 1965 are 5 times more likely to have hepatitis C, which often has no symptoms, but is a leading cause of liver cancer. The good news? Treatments are available that can cure hepatitis C. Talk with your doctor about getting a blood test for hepatitis C. Know for sure. A message from the CDC.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Deployed the first new nuclear weapon since the end of the Cold War, and it's gone by almost without anybody even noticing, and it's occurring under Donald Trump.
And welcome to WHFR Journal. This is Sam Tylo sitting in. I have been doing a show every month or so, and today I'm featuring an interview I had with Heidi Otto and Dennis Kapinski over at the Yankee Air Museum, one of the hidden gems in the Detroit area. The Detroit area is blessed to have such hidden gems, you might say, because they're very popular, but then again, they could always be more popular. We've got, like, Fort Wayne, we've got the Henry Ford, the DIA, Meadowbrook, and the Taylor Conservancy, and the Yankee Air Museum. It's important because this is the 75th anniversary now of the end of World War II. And this year they have some special exhibits and special events going on to help commemorate that end of the worst disaster in humankind, which of course was World War II, which involved every continent of the globe, including Antarctica, believe it or not, and also included the highest death rate, the highest amount of destruction, and the highest monetary costs of property loss and just total destruction in some fields. And anyway, I'm going to get back to playing this special interview that I had. And we'll be discussing everything from the Yankee Air Museum and its purpose to Rosie the Riveter and history of the Yankee Air Museum.
Welcome to WHFR Journal. My name is Sam Tylo. I am a monthly host here, and I have the honor and the privilege of having a conducted tour here at the Yankee Air Museum, located at Willow Run Airport, where American history lives. And I'm here with Heidi and Dennis. And Dennis Kapinski, right?
Yes, it is.
And Heidi Otto.
Correct. Thank you.
Well, welcome. thank you for letting me in and giving me a tour. Heidi, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do here? And
Right now, I'm on the Public Relations Committee, and my primary focus is a celebration we're putting together for the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. I got involved in the Yankee Air Museum because my father was a World War II combat veteran. He was an airplane mechanic for the Navy in the Pacific Theater. My mother was a Rosie the Riveter, and she made the de-icer boots for the B-24 bombers. She worked for B.F. Goodrich in Cadillac, Michigan, and the parts were shipped down here. So I work as a volunteer at the museum to honor the memory of my parents.
That's really awesome. Dennis, tell me a little about yourself.
Hey, I'm Dennis Skupinski, and I'm the chairman for the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II Home Front Victory Celebration, which is going on. We're having a kickoff event May 15th through 17th. This year at the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Marriott Ypsilanti at the Eagle Crest Resort. And one of the things we have a display in the museum we just got done setting up that talks about the history of Willow Run and also the home front campaign, which was waged to keep the workers engaged in the war effort because a lot of sacrifices there was a lot of sacrifices by the workers as far as themselves and their families to produce the goods needed for the war. And before then, I was chairman of Michigan's World War I Centennial Commission, and I collect military uniforms and stuff, and that's how I got involved with Yankee Air Museum back during my World War I Centennial days.
You've been a history buff a long time, both of you.
Yes.
Well, it's a fascinatingly beautiful museum you have here. How did the Willow Run plant get started that eventually led to the Yankee Air Museum?
Well, the plant itself was constructed by Henry Ford. And the construction and the concept to build bombers here happened before the U.S. entered the World War II. So from that point to the Yankee Air Museum, the Yankee Air Museum was conceived by some local pilots, aviation enthusiasts, around 1983, I think they became a nonprofit. And so the museum itself has taken on a life of its own, and when General Motors went through their bankruptcy and their reorganization, the museum was put in a very unique position to save part of the original bomber plant with the Save the Bomber Plant campaign, which we have done, and we've preserved that. Right now, the museum is housing some artifacts, some airplanes inside of that former bomber plant, and we have preserved it for future use.
Oh, that's very interesting. Now, why did they want to tear down the plant? Was it just not you couldn't be used anymore? Or?
I think it was in disrepair.
Yeah, and they tried to sell it, but there wasn't a buyer for it.
Oh, I see.
And so the Yankee Air Museum, they started a campaign to save the bomber plant. Not the whole bomber plant, but like 1% of it, the last part of the bomber plant where the planes would leave to go out and fly.
Well, that sounds like the most important end of it anyway. And I like that interesting thing about Henry Ford not wanting to build the plant in Washtenaw County. It ends right where the county line is.
Right. The plant actually was built in Wayne County and didn't go over, or Washtenaw County, and didn't go over the Wayne County line because he didn't want to pay taxes on the planes that came out of the assembly line. So the end of the assembly line turned 90 degrees. So the hangar door would open, and they pushed the planes out onto Washtenaw County instead of Wayne.
That's very interesting. And
was very smart. Henry Ford was a very smart businessman.
Yeah, it was the federal government wanting to build more bombers, and they knew Henry Ford could build cars on assembly line process, and so they tried doing this during World War I, and so when World War II was coming, they wanted to go to the automobile industry and see if they could mass produce airplanes, because before then airplanes were built one at a time.
Right.
And there wasn't really interchangeable parts, and they wanted to see if they could outproduce the access powers, and so they went to the automobile companies and said, okay, let's see if you guys can build airplanes the way you build cars. People thought they were crazy, but Henry Ford showed them that he wasn't.
At peak production, they produced one B-24 bomber every 55 minutes.
Wow.
There were two assembly lines going.
Wow. And they produced, what, 8 or 10,000 here or something?
It was over 8,600.
8,600, wow.
Well, one of the things, this is about the 75th anniversary. This is sort of the last time we'll be able to give thanks to the greatest generation. Because I know with the World War One, when they came to the 75th anniversary, there was maybe 10,000 veterans. By the time they got to the 80th, there was hardly anybody. And so this is the 75th anniversary is basically going to be the last big celebration, because the veterans right now are in their 90s, and, you know, they're not going to be around probably for the 80th and the 85th and the 90th. So this is really the, excuse me, the last time we'll be able to, you know, talk about them with them being there.
I find that very fascinating.
Well, I have been to Pearl Harbor, and I had a very unique experience there. Pearl Harbor offers people who were witnesses to the bombing of Pearl Harbor will volunteer to talk to people in the general public.
Ooh.
And the day that I visited, one of the days I visited Pearl Harbor, because when I was in Oahu, I went back multiple times because I was very drawn to it. It's what convinced my father to enlist in the military. There was a gentleman there that spoke with me that his wife knew my father from Ann Arbor, Michigan, because he came to Ann Arbor as an officer. He enlisted after the bombing. And he was taught how to plan a battle based on the weather, how to do things. They were doing this at the University of Michigan at the time. It was the first time they had used meteorology in planning attacks, and in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the University of Michigan, they would have dances. So this is where this gentleman met his wife. Because the local women would come to these dances to dance with these gentlemen who were officers. That's how my father's sister met her husband and ended up marrying him and going on as a military wife. Well, this gentleman's wife knew my dad from church, from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm all the way in Oahu at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu, and who do I meet? Somebody that knew my dad, which is crazy. It's crazy how these connections happen and how this war connected. The Doolittle raid was in response to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Captain Doolittle decided that he would take an aircraft carrier and put bombers on it, and Japan felt like they were insulated or nobody could bomb them because they're an island out in the middle of the ocean. How do you get an airfield close enough to an island to bomb them? That was Doolittle's inspiration.
Yeah. Did he have a hard time selling it to the government?
No, he didn't, because he was, first of all, he had an aeronautics degree. And second of all, he was one of the best pilots in the country at the time. And when he came up with his sort of harebrained idea, the military was looking for a way to strike back at the Japanese, to show the American public that, you know, we weren't just going to take it.
Right.
That we can also dish it up. And by doing that, they sort of put Japan on the defensive, so they couldn't put all their resources into just expanding. They had to keep some of it back to protect the homeland, because there might be more raids like this from, you know, aircraft carriers or wherever. They didn't know at the time where this came from. But they says President Roosevelt said it came from Shangri-La.
Yeah, a secret base or something. Right,
right. And so the Japanese didn't know where this raid came from, so they had to keep more resources back to protect Japan than use them for expansion.
So it had a double mission, to raise American spirits and tie up Japanese resources.
Correct.
Like the gentleman who volunteered for that mission, knew that it was a one-way mission when they volunteered.
Yeah.
And they were not told what they were going to be doing until they were in the middle of the ocean.
I see.
They were not planning on returning. But most of the guys survived.
Yeah.
Most of the planes landed behind Allied lines, and a few of them didn't survive. A few of them were captured, but
sure,
the majority of them did really well.
Yeah, didn't one land in Russia, too, I think?
I think so.
They were picked up by the Russians.
Yeah.
Both of them were picked up by the Chinese nationalists.
Yeah, that's... And I always thought that was an interesting aspect of World War II. The Japanese and the Russians weren't at war, so they had to kind of respect each other's stuff that was going on. But that's like an aside. But so you have a lot of artifacts from the Doolittle Raid here, too.
We do. We have a bottle of cognac that was donated, because the Doolittle Raiders were famous for doing their annual cognac toast in their silver goblets.
Yes.
And as the members of their team passed away, they would turn the goblet upside down.
Yeah.
And when there were two left, they stopped doing the toast, I heard. And this past year, Dick Cole, who was Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot, passed away at the age of 105.
Wow.
That our volunteers built, they have over 40,000 hours in building that.
But we also have World War II flyables, and so that's one of the other aspects where there isn't a lot of museums that you can actually get into a World War II airplane or Warbird and fly in and see what it was actually like. We have a B-25 that flies, we have a C-47 that flies, and a B-17, and you can ride in all these airplanes during the summer months, usually May through October, and experience what it was like, you know, 75, 80 years ago.
Wow.
Which is unusual, because there's only, like, for the B-17, there's only, I think, less than 10 flying right now.
Wow.
So.
And out of the thousands of those that they built, that was...
Yeah. The other thing is, I don't want to rush people, but those airplanes aren't going to be flying forever. Eventually, the airframe's going to be, you know, the FAA isn't going to let them fly it. So if you're interested in flying, you might want to make it a priority if it's on your bucket list.
Oh, sure. That's that's interesting, because SkyTrain, wasn't that like based on a civilian design or something?
Douglas DC-3.
DC-3,
wow. They militarized it and turned it into a C-47 so they could put a bigger cargo door on it so you can get in Jeeps and carry passengers and loads and use it for paratroopers and all sorts of things.
Oh, okay. And the B-17, was a heavy bomber, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. They use that in Europe and over in the Pacific, too.
Okay.
But basically, the home front in Michigan, what it was like to work in a factory, what it was like for the people, you know, that lived in Michigan at the time, not just servicemen, but their wives, girlfriends, and parents that lived at home, what it was like to grow up as a child during World War II, because everybody was affected, because this was a total war, so they had rationing of gasoline, tires, rationing of different types of food. So they had, we've got some cookbooks on display that shows you how to save wheat, save meat, etc., and other things of saving. We've got coupons and little round tablets they had for change for your rations for gas and other things like that. So you can come and see all this stuff on display. Aviation on the Great Lakes. During World War II, we had two carriers that were used for training in Lake Michigan. And so we have a display devoted or dedicated to that. And we have a Dauntless dive bomber that's crashed in the bottom of Lake Michigan that we have on display in our deep water landings display. And with that, we have a lot about carrier aviation, what it was like and what it was like for the crew and some of the things you had to know in order to be part of that group.
Yeah.
The hump was at China-Burma-India Theater, and it's flying over the Himalayas because the Lido Road was cut, and the Burma Road was cut, so the only way they could get supplies to the nationalist Chinese was to fly supplies in from India. So they had to load up the plane and fly them over the Himalayas, which was a pretty big feat because the Himalayas were pretty high and there's a lot of different air currents there. So they lost a lot of airplanes doing that, but they wanted to keep the Chinese in a war fighting the Japanese.
Yeah, I think a lot of people weren't aware that the Chinese were our allies in the World War II.
Yes, even Chairman Mao's communists were on our side fighting the Japanese.
Oh, okay. They didn't get along after the war.
Right, after the war, they realized that, well, during the war, everybody combined to fight the Japanese because they were the invader. And then afterwards, they went back to their, you know, their own civil war they had.
And
so we honor Dick Cole. He flew over the hump in a C-47 after he was part of the Doolittle Raid. And our C-47 Skytrain is painted in honor of that mission, Hairless Joe. So Hairless Joe is available. These flyables are available at historic Willow Run Airport. They fly on a schedule during the summer. You can access the schedule through our website. And it's safety is our number one thing. So if the weather's like a little cross-eyed, if it's a little windy or a little rainy, we're not going to take the planes out. Kind of like a classic car.
You don't
take your classic car out in bad weather. Well, we don't take our flyables out in bad weather. So
I wouldn't either. I mean,
but we have a wonderful air adventure program available at Willow Run Airport during flying season. And then we have a schedule of air shows around the Midwest. We go to different places in Michigan and Ohio, Pennsylvania. We'll be in Washington, D.C. in May. Just it depends on what's going on. You can find us. So we can, you know, you can check us out. It's fun.
Well, I was interested in all of them. Is that the one that John McCain was shot down in?
That was a Skyhawk.
That was a Skyhawk.
Or Skyhawk.
Okay.
Yeah, that's on loan from the Navy.
Oh, okay. Well,
a subsonic nuclear missile launcher.
Ah, that's. I understand you have a B-52 here in the museum environs.
We have a B-52 on the grounds of Willow Run Airport. Right now, it's in a static display outside, and we've had a team working on doing some restoration of the B-52. It's not going anywhere, but you can look at it through the fence right now.
No, that's cool, though. I just find it fascinating that it's a plane still in service, and it's going to be in service another, I think they have another 20, 30 years planned for it, and it was designed before I was born, you know.
Right. The C-47 went into service. The DC-3 was designed in the mid-1930s, and the military used it through Vietnam.
Yeah, I believe it's used a lot now still, isn't it? And, I know the Canadian, the airlines in the far north still use the DC-3s.
It's a preferred plane because it can land on a shorter runway.
I see.
And it can carry a really heavy load.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a plane of choice for dropping food in Berlin when Berlin was cut off after World War II. The C-47 was one of the planes that would land and drop supplies.
Yeah, and you know when they were building the planes here, it was fascinating how they kept them up to date on. I see you got a display area how they used to keep them up to date on the war effort and how things were going in the different campaigns.
Right, with the news maps they used to send out every week during the war, and it usually get put in their cafeteria, where one side would have what went on in each theater of the war, with some pictures, and on the other side of the news map would be something about either like the one we have on display, the backside has about the U.S. Navy, the different types of ships that they have, so you can identify them. But that's something to keep it gets the message out and keeps the people informed so that they don't have to go looking for information, and the government can keep them focused on what we're doing, and so they don't get different stories about, you know, whether we're winning battles or losing battles.
Yeah.
It comes right to them, and they can see what the government's telling them instead of hearing from other people who might give the wrong answers that the government doesn't want them to hear.
Well, sure, loose lips sink ships kind of thing.
Correct.
And I imagine there was rumors it would abound if they hadn't had the information going on like that.
One thing I was going to bring up, too, which we haven't talked about, but you talked about the museum and we have the flyables.
Yes.
One of the other things we do is we have an air show that's called Thunder Over Michigan.
Yes.
Which is August 29th and 30th this year.
Yeah.
On a Saturday and Sunday. And that's something where we have, and this year we have the Blue Angels coming in.
Oh, great.
And so we just wanted everybody to know that, you know, this is something we do. We have vintage aircraft coming in and also modern-day aircraft coming in. And they do, they have stunt planes, they have military planes, they have flying exhibitions, and they have they have reenactors doing land and air combat. So it's sort of creating what it was like during World War II. Ooh. Plus we have plane rides then, too. We have our planes, they have helicopters, and they have some other planes, too, that give rides during that weekend. So it's a whole weekend for the whole family for aviation. So it's a... And it usually goes from about 9 until 4 on Saturday and Sunday, August 29th and 30th.
That's an excellent event. Do you have other events you do over the course of the year, too?
We do, but this year's the big event is the 75th anniversary, which we're doing May 15th through 17th, and then the air show. And because we've got a lot of other things going on this year, we're not really doing much else. Usually we have all these other events going on.
I see.
Well, we have a speakers bureau on Wednesdays.
Oh, yeah.
On the first Wednesday of the month. And the information is available through our website, and it's available through Meetup. So that's, we have a Facebook page, too.
Oh, very nice.
Yes.
And there's a website, too, you said?
Yeah, the website for the Yankee Air Museum. You can just go to yankeeairmuseum.org. And if you're interested in events, just a /events.
Very nice.
Yes.
Yeah, that's, you have quite a collection of planes. I see you got several helicopters also.
We have one flyable that we're rolling out for Air Adventures this summer.
Okay.
That you'll be able to take flights on. It's a UH-1 Huey of Vietnam era helicopter. And we also have a static display helicopter on the floor of the museum.
That's very nice. And I like the idea that you have some interactive displays, too, and you have things for all ages, really.
Well, part of the museum's focus is education. It's very important to the museum to help support children in learning about things that are going to help them be good students, good citizens, you know, people who are interested in science, technology, engineering, mathematics. That's part of the focus, because you need strength in those areas to support aviation, military, you know, just a good government system.
So it's like a multi-purpose outreach program, yeah.
And one other thing I was going to mention about the STEM program, the science and stuff, is that they have a special, was it a day or a couple of days when they have women in aviation come in, and they talk about women in aviation. You usually get a couple of pilots, and they have, you know, they have schoolgirls come in from various schools here. They, I think they get about 100, don't they? And they have a whole program for them to get them interested in, you know, science and math and aviation.
We've also been running, I think it's the first Saturday each December, a program for Boy Scouts.
Oh, very nice.
And
very
I've
nice.
Been involved with that because of my connection to, I trained with NASA to do Girl Scout programming, and so I use my resources to help support the Boy Scout program also.
Oh, were you a scout?
I was a scout, and then I was also an adult volunteer with the Girl Scouts. Yes. And I've also been a Boy Scout Merit Badge counselor.
Oh, very nice.
Because of my work at the museum. So
you really do make an effort to really reach out to the community and educate and
it's so important to give opportunities to young people so they can see that there's something beyond their school ground or whatever is coming in through the television.
Yeah, because it's nice to have that, because it's living history and not just a...
Right. Well, that's what we want to do. We want to connect you with living history. We want you to be able to get the goosebumps, get up in that B-17 or that B-25 and hear how that engine sounds and take off and get those goosebumps and go, wow, I'm flying in a B-25D that actually saw combat during World War II. There's only two flying in the country, and we own one.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can experience that here. Another thing, to get back to the home front celebration,
yes,
we have some activities that are free and open to the public. On Saturday morning, May 16th, we do what's called buffing the bomber. Bomber buffing, it's a polishing party that takes place at Hangar 1. You come, you get a little can of aluminum polish, you get a rag, and you can touch the airplanes. You know how sometimes you go to a show and they say, don't touch. Well, we welcome people to come and touch and interact. We've got guys that come back every year to buff our planes to get them ready for the show season, the summer season for flying. So that's something that's going to be in the summer, in May. We also, on Sunday, May 17th, we are going to have a free concert at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
In conjunction with the Washtenaw Community Concert Band, they have been practicing music. The theme is Salute to Victory, 75 years. And we're celebrating the end of World War II with the music that was popular at the end of World War II. And parking's free in Ann Arbor on Sundays.
Oh.
And this is going to be a free event.
That's good to know.
Yeah, as long as they don't change the rules between Ann Arbor. But you know how they change rules. But So this is something that's going on in conjunction with the Homefront Victory Celebration 75 years. And those events are free and open to the public.
Well, that's very good. Now, I have a quick question about, running the museum and stuff. It's a large percentage of your budget just trying to maintain these planes, isn't it?
A lot of the work that is done here is done by volunteers.
Oh, that's good.
Museum has thousands of volunteers.
Wow.
There is maybe a dozen staff people. We have a fabulous staff here that gives us direction, and we have volunteers, retired mechanics, people from the military, people who served in aviation careers that come and work on our planes.
Okay. I had a question about planes, too. It seems like most of the planes, especially World War II, but maybe even to this day, they have names. How did they get names? Who usually named them? I find that fascinating. Was it usually the pilot or somebody?
Well, Hairless Joe was because of the one Doolittle's co-pilot. That was a plane he flew in that over the hump in the China Burma India Theater. The Yankee Warrior and the Yankee Lady, I don't know how they chose those.
I believe that they picked names with the word Yankee in them because we're the Yankee Air Museum.
Oh, okay, that would make sense.
I think that's where the inspiration, but those names were most likely, the planes had other names before we got them.
I see.
And they also had other nose art, and we have the G-rated version of the nose art.
Versus the risque.
Yes, World War II people.
Yes.
They put a lot of very risque art on the nose of airplanes.
But that's what happens when you get young men overseas for so long.
You get them up, yeah.
Yeah, they...
they think about back home and the girl they like or whatever.
And you have this fabulous escape display for Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah, what would you like to know about Rosie?
Well, I know a little bit about her, but you know a lot more about her than I do. And I love the Rosie the Riveters. I mean, how many have been gotten together different times? But tell me a little bit about the history of why she became Rosie the Riveter, things like that.
What I'd like to do is share with you that we have a fabulous Rosie the Riveter tribute team, and it's run by Allison Beatty, and she does a fabulous job getting the word out about Rosie the Riveter. She's the one that organizes things like the Rosie the Riveters being in the Michigan or the Detroit 4th of July parade.
Okay.
You watched the parade, you saw, and the woman who won the art band, remember they had a competition or a salute to someone who had dedicated so much time to volunteering?
Yeah.
Well, this year's 2019 art band's winner that was represented in the Detroit Thanksgiving Parade was Virginia Bassler.
Okay.
Virginia Bassler is an original Rosie the Riveter. She worked at the plant at Willow Run in the bomber plant, and she's a volunteer here.
Wow.
And I've seen her working in the store, in the gift store in the museum. She's in her, like, she has to be at least, well, I know when you're past 90, you know, she has to be at least 95.
Wow.
But, that is the tribute to these women, because what Rosie the Riveter did was it allowing women to get into manufacturing positions to support the war effort was the first time women were allowed in manufacturing. And Henry Ford encouraged it.
Yes.
Henry Ford's been credited as the greatest innovator of our last century. And he had the idea that it didn't matter who you were, where you came from, we were going to figure out how to use your skill set or what you were capable of to move our project forward. And that was some of the inspiration for the Rosie the Riveter. Women used to get a job, then they'd get married, then they'd quit their job, or when they got pregnant, they got fired because women were expected to go home, take care of their house, take care of their husband. I mean, that was the pre-World War II prescription for what a woman was supposed to do. But Rosie the Riveter is like a feminist hero. It's an icon that we can identify with. So, hey, we can do it too. We did it too. We're here too. And so if there's any women out there that would like to join a group of like-minded women, we do have Rosie the Riveters, who are a tribute organization to those ideals. And Allison Beatty is the leader of that volunteer section of the museum, and she welcomes people joining.
So, and she's the one that also organized getting the thousands of Rosies together?
She has been very instrumental in doing the Guinness World Book of Records. Yes, she's been very instrumental in organizing that.
And what else but a place like this to have that record?
Right.
To organize it, because
we've been pushing the record back and forth with another group in California.
Oh, okay.
So we're kind of rivals, so we got a little bit of that rivalry.
Well, we were there, so a little democracy, of course.
Well,
Michigan.
Yeah, I think it was the national largest. There were different pockets of arsenals of democracies in the country, and I think that southeastern Michigan was the largest one in the nation.
I think so.
We built ships in Bay City. We built machine guns in Saginaw. In Kellogg's did rations.
Right.
I mean, it's just a whole different group of industries and organizations coming together for a common purpose.
I really, it just ties in so well with what made, you know, the spirit of that really made Detroit great. And I think that hopefully we're going to keep this research to spirits in Detroit going on.
That's Detroit really has a reputation of the hustle. Like, Detroit really knows how to hustle.
We do.
And get stuff done.
Yeah.
And I think that the bomber plant is an example of that in the history of southeastern Michigan and that hustle.
Well, I'm proud of y'all for being able to save part of it is and keep it as part. I know it, you know, in America, it's funny, a building gets 50 years old and it's obsolete. But you've really done a great job with this kind of thing. I find that just the fact that it had two assembly lines and the display of the like, you got the turret, the machine gun turret.
Yes, the turret that Tucker designed.
Yeah.
Tucker, who was the automotive designer for the Tucker car, he made his money during World War II with the turret.
Wow. You had to be a pretty small guy to get in that thing, eh?
Oh, yeah. The turret, I said, you had to be 130 pounds or lighter to fit in that, in there. And Dennis was saying, I don't know, were you making a joke?
No. The average size back then was like 5'6", and they weighed about 120 pounds was the average weight of stuff for a World War II service member. So, yeah.
I mean, nowadays it would be a problem. I don't know. Is it all that good food and all the vitamins that we feed our kids now?
I'm not sure. I think it has something to do with the dairy and stuff, too, because it was not. But then again, I don't know.
Who knows?
I'm a nurse, not a nutritionist.
Okay.
But I mean, I look at that B-17, and it's just fascinating as to how many guns that thing carried, and you know how many pounds of bombs it could carry at a time, roughly, you know, or
what is it, like 8,000?
Wow.
I think.
Oh, and if they didn't release, the guys would go and stomp on them, so right. they would have to go back and stomp on them so they would release.
Because they didn't want to land with bombs.
They couldn't land with bombs.
Well, you could, but didn't want to.
Oh my
God. Oh, yeah. And from my reading, there was an area of the ocean where if you, for some reason, couldn't drop your bombs, you had to come back. You had to drop them in this part of the ocean where they kind of cordoned it off from, you know, regular shipping and stuff so that you could jettison your bombs so you could land safely. Otherwise, it was a watery landing or something, and if for ball turret gunner, it would have been the end for him, most likely. Did you have to be even smaller to get into the ball turret? Because that thing,
yeah, they were volunteers that did that because really? There was one of the least link positions on the bombers. That or the person in the very back is going to be all by yourself there for the whole flight.
Wow!
And then the ball turret was you're underneath the bomber. And so, if there was any kind of issue with the ball turret, you were locked in there, and if they couldn't get the landing gears down, you weren't going to come out alive.
Wow.
You couldn't get out.
Yeah, so it was one of those things where you had a volunteer to do it, and some people loved it, and usually it helped to be small because that's a real small area to get into.
Yeah, it
you're
really
locked
is.
In there, so you're separated from everybody else on the plane.
So, wow, that's amazing, you know. But, you know, everybody did their duty back then. You don't hear anything about, I'm sure there were people that, you know, couldn't serve, but I remember the story of John Kennedy. He was like 4F or something, but he used his political connections to get into the service, you know. Now politicians use their connections to avoid service, which is, it's sad, not setting a good example, but. Why they call them the greatest generation, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then, if you went to Harvard or Yale or one of those big schools like that, it was your duty to lead America. That's why they went to the service. Nowadays, if you go to those schools, you're probably protesting.
You could be, yeah. There's,
so.
But, yeah, so, you know, do you have, you know, I've interviewed at the Durban Historical Museum, and they have a lot of things they don't have enough display space for. Is there stuff that you rotate in and out of display that...
They do, and they also have a lot of it back in our collections department so that in the future, if they want to rotate something out, if they want to change, like we've got that new Deep Water Landings exhibit, well, we've got stuff that we could bring in for that. Because in the future, you never know what you're going to have or come in or what's going to be going on. So we've got some stuff in the back that we can pull out different types of uniforms, different types of artifacts.
Yeah.
And it's like for this home front victory celebration, we pulled out just about everything we had that had to deal with Willow Run and the home front, where most of this stuff was sitting in the back in the boxes, and we only had a little bit on display. Now we pulled that out and for this, so who knows what, you know, 5 years from now in our new museum, they might be having different displays and, ooh, you know, just because you got to keep it interesting.
Sure.
A reason for people to come back in, like right now, we've changed the museum around, so we've got the deep water landings, and we've got the 75th anniversary Homefront Victory Celebration display, so there's a reason. So if you were here 6 months ago, you haven't seen these displays, so now there's a reason to come back and come into the museum.
Oh, and you're planning a new museum? Is that...
Well, eventually we hope to either get into the Willow Run, the building that we bought,
okay,
part of it that we saved, or have a new museum along with our new aeronautical center that we're building.
Oh.
Because they're closing the hangar where our airplanes are, and so they have to build a place to house these airplanes.
Yeah.
So they're going to be building that on the Willow Run airport grounds.
Oh, okay.
So that's coming up in the future, probably this year, I think.
Well, what we're doing is we're building a home for our flyables, and we're continuing to build a new aeronautics center for these historic machines. This is our most immediate need. We have a fundraising goal of $4 million.
Wow.
And as of December 19th, the current need was just to borrow $1 million. We would like to offset the construction loan as much as possible to limit that debt burden.
Of course.
So therefore, we're going to continue to fundraise for the site for our flyables. And we've been working with the WCAA. We're actually connected with Metro Airport.
Oh, okay.
The WCAA. And we've been working with...
The following program is a rebroadcast of Live from Studio.
It's been determined that the site that we're going to build on is the east side of Willow Run Airport, which is just a few blocks away from this building. So this is our primary focus. We really need to protect that historic aircraft collection we have. It's like a classic car. You don't leave your classic car sitting in your driveway for the winter.
No, you don't.
So it really needs to be in a garage where you can do a little maintenance to get it ready for the next driving season. So that's our focus right now.
And one thing I'll say, it isn't a little maintenance. It's actually a lot of maintenance.
Yes, it is. They literally tear down and rebuild every one
because
of those.
They have to be inspected by the FAA every year.
I see.
So they have to tear things down and put it back together again. So
they're gone through with a fine tooth.
So you don't really have enough space to store all the planes you have now.
Well,
I mean, it sounds like.
We're using Hangar 1, but the trouble is that the airport authority is tearing that building down to make space for some other new builds.
I see.
So we have to, that's where our plane is, where our planes are right now. So we have to find a new facility, and that's why we have to build one. So
that was the best plan to come up, that they came up with, was to build a new facility to house our flyables.
Do you have planned fundraising events like
Right now, the only thing we're doing is we're sending out fundraising letters. They've got a campaign online going, and like what we're doing now, we're talking about it. And, you know, there isn't really anything else, you know, as far as the fundraising goes.
Oh, okay. Well, anytime you get any, please let us know at WHFR. Oh. We'll be happy to announce them and help out, you know.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
thank you.
It's a pleasure because I have a love of history, and, you know, I have a regular show I do on Mondays, but they asked me if I wanted to do some of these journal shows, and I love interviewing, you know, museums. I interviewed a gentleman, Aaron Bartles. He he sponsored the 5K run and got going at the head in Taylor last summer for the VFWs at Taylor and Wyandotte, and anything I could do for veterans. You know, that's why I sing the anthem, because, you know, it's for them guys. I don't, you know, I don't.
Well, organization attracts a lot of veterans, and it's not uncommon to find a retired military giving tours of the museum. So, because we do have docents that when you come to the museum, you get a tour if you choose to take it, or they're available to answer any questions.
So, wow. Yeah, that's really a good thing. And do you have anything else that you have tucked it up there and coming up in the back pocket?
Like I mentioned before, we have our speaking series the first Wednesday of the month at 7:30. The speaking takes place in classrooms at the museum. The doors open at 6:30 and they close at 8. So we have a presentation March 4th, The Revolt of the Admirals, The Flight to Save Naval Aviation and the USMC. And it's a gentleman who's written a book, and these are usually very informative. I know one time I came and the gentleman had been a Vietnam POW and he talked about his experience.
Because that whole thing, Revolt of the Admirals, I think that was the battleship admirals didn't really want aircraft carriers and naval aviation or something, if I remember right.
Well, I'm not an expert, but if you come on Wednesday 4th, you can enjoy a talk from Randy, and I'm sure he's the expert, and that's why he'll be speaking.
I'd love to come.
Yeah.
And if I was an elementary school teacher, could I contact a museum and they have a field trip, or even for middle or high school?
We do organize field trips. There are schools that come. This is a barrier-free facility. We've had visually impaired people come and take tours. Our docents were trained on how to manage a tour with people who are visually impaired.
Oh.
So we do special things. We have adult foster care groups that come on tours.
Oh, great.
We have, this is for everybody. This museum welcomes. Our doors are open. We welcome people. If you have an interest, and we're here to help you learn.
It's a very, very noble cause. I think it's because this is important. I mean, I know we... In Detroit, we always have prided ourselves on our industriousness and our industries and stuff, but a lot of times, things get neglected and torn down, but you guys have done so much to preserve American history. I mean, you got 100-plus years of history here in one building.
Yeah, it is amazing. And one of my favorite artifacts is the SPAD. And like I said before, we have 40,000 plus volunteer hours in building that. There was a gentleman that hand-carved the propeller on that one.
Wow.
I know. And where do you find dedication like that?
It's hard to find somebody with the skills to do that.
Oh, yeah. And this place attracts people with skills like that because they're honored and respected.
And I especially like... I forgot the name of it already, but you have a glider that was actually built here in Ypsilanti?
Oh, the Franklin glider.
The Franklin glider.
Yes, we have on display, and there's only one seat in it. So when students come through, I explain to them that this was built when they didn't have a cell phone, so they had to pay attention to what the instructor was saying, because once you got up there, you were on your own, because there's not a second seat, and you can't use the phone to call for help.
Oh, yeah.
Their eyes just get really wide when I explain it to them that way.
Yeah, that's it. And that was built here at Ypsilanti.
Yes, the Franklin glider, and there's a Franklin glider at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
The Texaco Franklin glider. There was competitions where people would fly, like, from one side of the country to the other in gliders, and they would spend so much time flying, and then they would do an exhibition or something at the end of their flying day. And
Oh, it's just amazing because we went on a tour, but I'm sure I didn't see everything there is to see, so I'm going to have to come back.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to come back.
I'd love to come back.
One other thing I was going to mention, besides coming back as a visitor, we'd like you to have you come back as a volunteer because we need volunteers for everything, whether you're skilled trades, whether you're, like me, my background was sales and marketing. They need people like that. They need people with your skills. So if you have a skill, we've got people that are ex-police officers that are in our security, or if you don't want to do that, we've got other places where you just have to find yourself your little niche, and there's all sorts of opportunities for volunteers here at the museum, and we always need them.
We always need volunteers because that is the heartbeat of this museum, is the volunteers. We have one gentleman in the PR committee that did over 700 volunteer hours last year.
That's like a part-time job.
That's like a full-time job.
It is it, but that's, it's just awesome that you have that, because I was talking to one of your gentlemen, just before we started the interview, and it's like, most people when they retire, but to continue volunteering and giving back is, it's... Mm-hmm.
I'm saying no matter what skills you have or if you want to develop new skills, this is the place to do it.
Yeah, and to me it's like Heidi put it the best. She's giving back to her parents.
I'm honoring the memory of my parents, yep.
And it's a way of thanking all of them for what they did. I mean, because, if we had stayed out of World War II, that war could still be festering today. I know what I wanted to ask. Contact information for the museum, like your address, phone number, things like that,
Well, we are located at the east side of Willow Run Airport. Our address is 4788 4D Street, Belleville, Michigan, 48111. For information, people can call 734-483-4030. And we're also on the internet, yankeeairmuseum.org.
Well, very nice. I want to thank Dennis Karpinski and Heidi Otto for taking the time to allow me to interview you. And I hope I help get you some volunteers. And maybe I'd love to come out and interview you again because, I'm doing the show regularly now and I like to revisit things.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more to talk about once this 75th anniversary of the end of World War II comes around.
Oh, I think so, and, it's just a beautiful thing because people forget about history, and you got to learn the lessons of history to prevent the same things from happening again. And a place like this is where you can get that education.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us, Sam.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and this is WHFR Journal, and we shall be back next week with another topic for discussion pertaining to your local communities. Thank you.
And yes, that was
Welcome to WHFR Journal. My name is Sam Tyler. I am a monthly host here, and I have the honor
just
of the
knowing history and being able to do history. And all that is a very important part of learning. You know where you're going if you sometimes know where the past has been. Anyway, this is Sam Tyler. I'll be signing off a journal. And I want you to have a great day.
Thank you for letting me.
And you guys all take care now because
Heidi, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do here?
Area is full of great things going on. Now, I'm just going to do a quick shout out for the Taylor Conservancy. I had hoped to be able to interview someone from that this time, but next time on Journal, they are having a Mardi Gras February 22nd to help raise funds for the Taylor Conservatory and Botanical Gardens. They're a beautiful area of gardens, a model of the conservatory from Belle Isle, over on the corner of North Line and Party in the beautiful city of Taylor. Coming up this summer, every Wednesday, they will have their summer series of concerts. And it's a beautiful venue to be at.
It's really awesome.
And I want to say that I really appreciate being here.
And
we will see you all next week on another
75th anniversary at the end of World War II, Homefront Victory.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
It's hard to keep track of all the health information that comes your way, but you still want to make the right decisions. Here's an easy one. Get tested for hepatitis C. It's a leading cause of liver cancer and often has no symptoms. People born from 1945 to 1965 are 5 times more likely to have hepatitis C. The good news is that now it can be cured. Talk with your doctor about getting a blood test for hepatitis C. Know for sure. A message from the CDC.
Are you a Dearborn resident 60 years or older? Did you know that you can take classes at Henry Ford College tuition free? Would you like to improve your computer skills, become an actor, an artist, or an auto mechanic, or enjoy one of 100 other classes? You could even find yourself on the radio like I did, and I did it tuition free at Henry Ford College. For a complete information and a list of classes, please visit our website at hfcc.edu.
Every day, across this country, hundreds of college radio stations take to the air, broadcasting music and programming that you won't hear anywhere else.
It's one of the last places where people can really be able to actually say what they want to say.
Without it, you wouldn't have a place for local artists to perform. Certain people need to have a chance, a fighting chance, and college radio is that place for it.
College radio changes the lives of those who are involved with it and can change those who listen to it, too.
This is where we start out, you know, from getting all this great experience working in college radio. It makes you want to work in real radio.
College radio means finding yourself. It helped me find what I wanted to do in not only school, but in life.
So support college radio by continuing to listen to this station and supporting the students who make it happen. College radio, now, more than ever. A message brought to you by this station and the College Radio Foundation. For more information, please visit collegeradio.org.
Henry Ford College's Mira News is looking for new writers. The newspaper is student-run and a great opportunity for budding journalists to gain experience. The Mira News covers a variety of topics such as politics, new restaurants, art exhibits, local events, and recent films. If you would like to share your talents, email Dr. Kim at pkim@hfcc.edu or the editor at editor@hfcc.edu. See yourself in the Mira News.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award.